Mesdames et messieurs, bonjour. Bienvenue au Collège de France. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Collège de France for this symposium. The idea of this symposium, in fact, came after the publication of several very interesting papers over the past four or five years, suggesting that we are really entering into some kind of a new open field now, after all these incredible achievement of making organoids and keeping organoids, now adding on top of this the possibility to produce and keep in culture pseudo-embryos or embryoids of all kinds, in fact. And of course, that brings a lot of concerns, ethical concerns, social concerns, economical concerns. But as far as this particular symposium is concerned, we deliberately decided to really focus on the scientific aspect for, I think that before entering into these societal discussions, it's absolutely essential to get the state-of-the-art information on what is going on. I'm absolutely delighted that everyone we invited accepted to come, and in fact, these are those people who are actually moving the field ahead, all leaders in these emerging fields. So I'd like to thank all the speakers for being there. Let me just mention that the talks are recorded. They'll be deposited on the site of the Collège, which is one of the missions of the Collège de France, which means that please do not ask questions during the talk, because they'll not be recorded and will make a hole. But you're much welcome to ask questions after, of course. There'll be a microphone. Chloe will make the microphone circulating. And also, if some of you wants to ask questions in French, there's no problem. We will have a sort of a on-the-spot translation, whatever. So I think that's all I wanted to say. There's going to be two breaks. You have a program. It's indicated coffee break. In fact, they're going to be break. And then I suggest we start right away with Ben Steventon, who comes from Cambridge and who is going to tell us about the Renaissance in experimental embryology. Ben?
Okay, good morning. Thank you very much, Denis, for the invitation. I'm really looking forward to the whole day. I think it's going to be a very interesting set of talks. So I think we're all here for a similar reason. And that's because we're all interested in trying to understand how embryos build themselves during development. So this is a fascinating process that involves the integration of information across multiple length scales. Individual cells have to make decisions and move to the right place, and tissues have to then form and undergo controlled morphogenetic deformations to build multi-tissue structures and to build an entire embryo, like you see here of a zebrafish embryo developing. Actually, now is a really exciting time to study this and to be a developmental biologist, in part because advances in technology means that we can get system-wide readouts of what's going on with all cells during development. And so this is a really beautiful study from Alex Shear's lab a couple of years ago now, where they've taken zebrafish embryos at different stages of development and sequenced all the cells within the embryo. And so then you can plot how cells move in gene expression space through time. So just a very simple way to depict what's going on during embryo development, which is this progressive restriction in cell fates. But this is only half the problem. The other half of the problem relates to how cells move to the right place. And equally, we can follow how cells move throughout the entire embryo through advanced imaging technologies. And so the real trick now is to try to combine these together to form an understanding of how self-organization happens during development. And so how do embryos self-assemble? How do cells communicate with one another to build complex structures? And self-organization has a long history in terms of our understanding of regulative development. And so I'm just going to give you a few of my favorite examples of self-organization during development. So the first one really was from Hans Driesch. You see here with sea urchin embryos isolating individual blastomeres. One of these blastomeres will actually go on to then form a complete embryo, although half of the size, showing how cells can regulate their behavior to accommodate for differences in size. Here's another example that's one of my favorites from Jane Oppenheimer, who is also a great historian of experimental embryology as well. And so she's taken explants of the blastomere away from killifish embryos and shown that they can actually still form a reasonably looking fish embryo. And actually this happens during normal development in some fishes. So here's an interesting example from annual killifish. So actually these embryos desiccate over the summer period. And so the cells completely disperse and then reform and actually self-organize the primary body axis. So this is, you know, self-organization during normal development. And the lab of Phil Abitua is taking on this project in really interesting ways at the moment. And finally, here's a great experiment from Christine and Bernard Thies, who Christine will talk to us a bit later today, where they've taken explants of the animal cap from zebrafish embryos now and just shown that actually simply by producing two opposing gradients of nodal and BMP, that's sufficient to generate a well-proportioned and patterned body axis in zebrafish explants. But how is this happening? How do cells regulate their fates, and how does self-organization happen? And I still don't think we have a good answer to this question. And I think this is a fundamental principle that we can now get at with many of the discoveries that you'll learn about later in this day. Now, I think it's fair to say that developmental biologists tend to think in terms of emergence. What I mean by this is that, you know, we tend to think about what genes do inside cells to drive cell behaviors, how cells move with respect to one another to drive tissue shape change, and how tissues talk to one another through inductive interactions to generate well-patterned embryos. But actually, to understand the principle of self-organization, we also need to think in the opposite way. So we need to think about downward causation. How do cells sense when there's been large-scale changes in the overall morphology or size of the embryo to accommodate for these large-scale changes that I showed you some examples of to generate self-organization? And this is what I mean by a renaissance in experimental embryology, because this is a field that actually undertakes these large-scale manipulations at the whole organism or multi-tissue level. And what's really exciting now is because of these technological advances, we can follow up what goes on in response to these changes and really start to understand this balance between emergent properties of development, which I think we understand increasingly well, and also downward causation, which I think drives us towards thinking again about experimental embryology in the context of developmental biology. And so I've been quite fortunate to have started my lab alongside the lab of Afonso Martinez Arias, and together with the labs of Denis de Boulle and Matthias Luthoff, they've developed the mouse gastroloid system, which are aggregates of embryonic stem cells in the mouse that spontaneously polarize and undergo germ layer patterning. And also Naomi Morris in Afonso's lab later showed that actually you can generate this with human embryonic stem cells too. And I think one of the most striking findings from this is this one here shown in Naomi's paper. And so what they've done here is a technique called TomoSeq, which is taking sections through the elongating gastroloids and then sequencing each one of these sections and aligning them along the anterior-posterior axis. What's quite striking is that so every line in this plot here corresponds to a particular gene. The intensity of the bars correspond to the levels of expression. And what's really striking is the match that you start to see between a human gastroloid and a mouse gastroloid. Very different species. These stages of development of these mammalian embryos look very different from one another. Yet when you've done these experiments of aggregating cells in vitro, you start to see these similarities emerge again. So this takes us back to some observations from Carlos von Speyer in terms of his laws of embryology. And he was actually postulating that we would really expect this to be the case. You know, so if you make small changes early on during a complex process, this is going to lead to secondary events and so on and so on, and that's going to propagate errors through the system. So really you expect there to be a large amount of developmental constraint acting on early stages of development. So really we would expect early embryos during gastrulation to look similar, but they don't. And so Denis has written several important reviews on this over the years, and this is termed the developmental hourglass, which shows how actually there's a large amount of morphological divergence at early stages. Then you go through this phylotypic process where a conserved body plant begins to emerge between different species, and then you diverge again to generate the species-specific differences. So how do we reconcile this paradox? Because actually the processes of gastrulation is very important, right? It's not something that you would expect evolution to be able to mess with all that easily. You know, this is the time at which the body plan is becoming patterned and cells are undergoing their germ layer decisions. So for such a critical process in development, how is it that there's such morphological flexibility? And so this is one of the first questions I want you to think about today. And so building on those observations from Alfonso's lab and others, we decided to test this a little bit further by trying to get as close as we can to that experiment, but now in zebrafish embryos. And so Vikas Trivedi, when he was a postdoc with Alfonso, and Andrea Attardi, who was an Erasmus master student in my lab, decided to take explants of the early zebrafish embryo, very similar to the ones that I showed you from Jane Oppenheimer, and then to culture them in vitro. And what happens here is that the cells progressively elongate over time and begin patterning. And this project was then continued by Tim Fulton in my lab to characterize what was going on there. And interestingly, what we see is that within a few hours of taking these explants, we start to see a polarization of early germ layer markers. You see two markers here of the early mesoderm, TBX16 and TBXTA. So much like what we see in mammalian gastroloids, these genes become polarized to the elongating tip. And later on, these structures can pattern in terms of distinct germ layers. So we have SOX2, which marks the neuroectoderm in the sort of non-elongating end, opposing the mesodermal elongating end. And we also get SOX17 marking endoderm within the center of the explants. But what's interesting about this is that actually, while we know that in the zebrafish there are maternal determinants that are patterning the early embryo prior to when we take these explants, there's a large amount of cell rearrangement happening in the explants themselves. So whatever positional information is present in the early explants is being progressively distributed across the explants as they undergo rearrangement. So these are two experiments just labeling an early portion of the explant and then following how these cells disperse across the expand over time. So here is a label of FDX that we've labeled the most vegetal regions prior to expanding the expand here, and that becomes distributed across the whole expand over time. And similarly, we can label small photo labels through a different approach, and those also disperse over time. Okay. So there's some degree of regulation, pattern regulation going on within the system that enables this maintenance of mesodermal specification despite the continual rearrangement of cells. One of these maternal determinants we know are to be inheritance of mRNAs that help specify early mesendoderm and on the most vegetal blastomeres of the zebrafish embryo. Surprisingly, we actually find that some of these maternal determinants are still expressed even within animal caps when we take these early stages, suggesting that even between this early stage of the 16 and the 256 cell stage, there's a large amount of rearrangement that's bringing these vegetal mRNAs up into the animal pole of the zebrafish embryo. And so what happens as the embryo begins to elongate then is an accumulation of nodal activity at the mesodermal pole of the gastroloid. And if you block nodal activity with the use of small molecule inhibitors, then you completely block this elongation. So that's to be expected. We know that nodal plays a key role in mesoderm specification during these stages of development. And what's happening actually is that you're getting an expression of Wnt PCP factors such as Wnt 11 and Frizzled at the elongating pole, and blocking of nodal blocks the expression of these molecules. And then if we specifically block either actomycin contractility with blebbistatin or by injecting a dominant negative of the PCP pathway, we can block this elongation. So that suggests then that nodal is somehow getting accumulated to the elongating end. That's driving the activity of PCP, which is then important for driving the elongation. And that's very consistent with what we know during normal embryo development. At the same time, two other key pathways that we know to be important for patterning the embryo become differentially expressed during the elongation. So initially, BMP7 is expressed ubiquitously across the explant, but as it begins to elongate, this is now only expressed within the non-elongating pole, and that coincides with the activity of a BMP reporter element to look for the activity of the pathway. And conversely, while Wnt activity, canonical Wnt signaling now is also ubiquitously expressed at early stages, this becomes located to the elongating pole. Okay. And as that happens, we then begin to pattern the neural tissue that sits in the middle there. So Crox20 is a gene that is known to be expressed within stripes within the hindbrain of the early nervous system. And these become expressed first in one stripe, then two as the expanse elongating. So we thought this might be a neat example to test this idea of downward causation then, because perhaps what's happening here is that it's the overall elongation of the explant that's actually allowing for the generation of these morphogen gradients that then lead to patterning of the embryo. So to test that, we went back to these treatments that I showed you a bit before, either with the injection of blebbistatin or, injection of a dominant negative PCP construct or the addition of blebbistatin. So this blocks the elongation, and in these experiments, we then no longer see this nice separation of the Wnt and BMP poles. And so actually that then corresponds with a loss of Crox20 expression. So this really suggests then that overall embryo elongation is one of the main driving forces in patterning in this example. Okay, and so that's just a summary of what I showed you. Essentially, many of the processes we know to be happening during early development also occur in these explants, but with this very different morphology, demonstrating a nice system to try to interrogate self-assembly during development. And so, because this has a similar overall morphology to what I showed you in the mouse and human gastroloids, we began to think more about what this might mean for this problem of the hourglass during early development. And perhaps one thing that's happening here is that maybe there is indeed a large conservation in many of the developmental processes across species to pattern the embryo, but that process is itself a self-organizing process, meaning that you can still generate a primary body plan even if you disrupt the normal morphogenesis of gastrulation, and that's what we're doing in the context of these experiments, is completely changing the way that gastrulation happens because we're removing all of the scaffolding that the extraembryonic tissues usually supply to these stages of development. And so maybe that's also what's happening in evolution. So one of the main reasons why gastrulation looks so different is because of alterations in reproductive strategies of vertebrate embryos, which change the extraembryonic tissues and the size of the yolk. For example, if you think about a transformation between a fish embryo to a bird embryo, there's a large increase in yolk size. So this imposes a morphological sort of pressure on the embryo itself, forcing these different morphologies. But because gastrulation is a self-assembling, self-organizing process, it can account for that and still generate conserved body plans nonetheless. So this is what we think allows for this bottom part of the hourglass structure that you see here. Okay, so what's this about? Right, so now we're thinking about, now we're going to think from the standpoint of being a stem cell biologist. And I think when we try to engineer stem cells in vitro to different endpoints, when we bring them together to form gastroloids and so on, I think we're essentially acting a bit like shepherds, okay? So what we're doing is we're instructing our little sheep. So, for example, maybe this one here is called, it's called Activin, and that's helping push the cells into different directions. And when we're doing this in the context of the 3D embryoids that you're looking at today, we're really forcing large-scale morphological changes by changing the matrix that's around the gastroloids or these other types of perturbations. And so what we need to do is to think in an engineering fashion about how do we manipulate the extrinsic boundary conditions of these systems to engineer these structures in a well-defined way to increase their reproducibility and morphology. And of course, the challenge here really is to think about patterning in this context, right? Because while we can manipulate the boundary conditions to change the morphogenesis of these structures, the individual cells have to alter their dynamics of gene expression to generate patterns of gene expression in the context of all these rearrangements that you're seeing in this example of sheep moving around. And actually, this problem of how you generate robust patterns in the context of cell rearrangement is something that happens reasonably extensively during early development, which is something that we've reviewed here. And so when we think of pattern formation, we often think about positional information, and then we then think about Wolpert's positional information model and his French flag analogy. So the idea here is that a morphogen might be forming a gradient across a tissue, and then cells respond with threshold type responses to then generate gene expression patterns. And then these patterns can be then refined over time through the gene regulatory interactions. But the question is, if cells are rapidly moving around within this time frame, how is it that you're maintaining these gene expression patterns in this context? And how is it that we can get understanding and be predictive about the emergency gene expression patterns in the context of complex morphogenesis? So here's just a few examples of that. So Claudia Stern's lab has studied over the years how cells move in and out of the early organizer at the anterior part of the primitive streak in chick embryos. So cells move into that region, take on an organizer fate, move out, lose that fate, and they're continually adjusting their dynamics of gene expression to allow for that. In the example that I'll show you now, in the elongation of the zebrafish embryo, the pre-Semitic mesoderm, there also cells are rapidly moving around, but yet still maintain expression patterns of these three T-box genes shown here. And of course, in the explant experiments and the gastroloids we've already discussed, there's a large amount of cell rearrangement, yet still a maintenance of gene expression patterns to generate germ layer patterning. So we've sort of used the zebrafish PSM as a model to get at this question, because it's quite accessible to live imaging, and we can generate cell tracks of all the movements going on within this tissue. And we can see that actually during its development, there's a nice progression in T-box expression from TBXTA to TBX16 to TBX6. And so the question is, how is it that these genes are responding to morphogens to maintain this gene expression pattern? So as I mentioned, a typical way to think about this is in terms of morphogen response. And in multiple systems, people have been able to reverse engineer gene regulatory networks that can be predictive of changes in this pattern over time in the response to known and measured morphogen gradients. And so we were very happy when Berta Verde joined the lab, who'd done a lot of this work before in the early Drosophila embryo. And she then took on the challenge of trying to reverse engineer a network that can be predictive of these gene expression patterns. So she worked with Tim Fulton again on this project, who had noticed that actually, if you put a label of cells within the most posterior tip of this tissue, over a few hours, this label would become completely dispersed. So that's telling you then that cells have to adjust their dynamics of transition through these gene expression states according to their particular position within the tissue over time. So some cells are going to maintain their TA expression state in the very posterior over this entire time course, where some will more rapidly move through within 3 hours to express TBX24, and others will sort of have a whole range within the middle there. And we also worked with Lewis Thompson, another PhD student in the lab, who is generating really nice tracking data of all the cell movements in this tissue. So the challenge really is to how do we fit a model to three different transcription factors, two signals, and a whole lot of cells moving around. And the idea that we had actually was to actually simulate the results of our networks on top of the tracking data. So we're using real morphogenesis as an input to understanding how patterns emerge during this process. So the first thing we did was to extract the pattern. We need to understand very well what is the pattern of gene expression and how does that change over time. We can do that using HCR, which is an in situ hybridization-based approach. We can then take readouts of the signaling gradients using our TCF reporter for canonical Wnt signaling and phosphorWNT antibody stainings for FGF signaling. And then we take all these different data sets, measure cell by cell the level of the transcription factor expression and the signal activity, and then map these on in 3D by registering them onto the tracking data. So now we have all this information in the same space, so we can see how cells move around, and we can and then predict and extract their changes in signaling and expression patterns as development's continuing. And we call these extracted gene expression trajectories AGETs, or approximated gene expression trajectories. Okay, so now we have an idea, or at least an estimation, of how cells are dynamically altering their gene expression as a consequence of the movements. So the next step then was to take these individual AGETs and to reverse engineer a set of network parameters that can be predictive of not just one particular dynamic, but all the different dynamics that we see from taking AGETs from different regions of the tissue. And so the output looks something like this. So we can find models that reasonably predict the stepwise changes in expression from different regions across the pre-Semitic mesoderm. And we then end up with a, you know, quite a large set of around 15 different network topologies, all of which can do a reasonable job of predicting these individual cell dynamics of expression. So the next step was to try to narrow down a bit more, you know, onto one particular network topology that can explain what's going on in vivo. And to do that, we turned to some explant assays that Tim was doing alongside this project. So what he was doing was taking out cells of the very posterior PSM, dissociating them and culturing them as individual cells in vitro. So then he can probe the changes in expression of the T-box genes in this very different context. So obviously now the cells are isolated, they're not exposed to Wnt or FGF gradients, and so they're actually in a very different sort of signaling environment, and yet they still change in their expression state over time, and actually what happens is quite a bimodal response, whereas one half of the population remains in a TBXT expression state, whereas the others go through and upregulate TBX6, as you see using the live reporter at the top there. And so we can then use this different dynamics to say, now, can we find one of these models that can both predict and give us a good fit to the AJETs, but now can we find one of these models that can also predict the dynamics that we see in vitro? So to do that, then, we need to give the model the changes in signaling, this different changes in signaling that they receive in the in vitro context. So we can take bulk populations and just look by qPCR at different readouts, such as AXIN2 for Wnt signaling and Sprouty4 for FTF. But we can also look cell by cell using our reporters and antibody stains to get an idea for each individual cell and what is the dynamics of their signaling inputs. So we take these then, and we use them as initial conditions to then run the modeling and ask which of these network topologies can also give us a good fit to this in vitro, these in vitro dynamics. And so then we come across one particular network topology that can also match these dynamics as well. So this then gives us a nice bimodal expression that I mentioned before that we see in both the measured and in the model predictions. So the final step of this then is to be able to actually go back to real morphogenesis, because all we've done is found a network that can sort of fit to individual trajectories around 10 different trajectories and also give us this very different dynamics in vitro. But can we actually find a model that maintains the gene expression patterns in a real morphogenetic situation? And this is what we call live modeling now. So what we're actually doing is taking all the tracking data, giving it the measured gradients of Wnt and FGF that we know from measuring the gradients of signal activity. And now for every time point of the tracking data, we update a cell's gene expression state according to its signal input that's measured empirically, and the gene regulatory interactions that come from our network that we've discovered. And what's really nice, actually, is that this does a reasonably good job of maintaining these boundaries of gene expression, even though cells are moving in and out of these regions. And so we think this approach is quite useful. Obviously, I'm not talking about organoids in this context here, but we think this approach could be very useful for the field, because what it would allow us to do is to take tracking data from organoid systems and be able to try to generate gene regulatory networks that can be predictive of changes in gene expression patterns when we perturb the morphogenesis in different ways. And so that's why I bring it to the community today. And so just to summarize then, I think that to understand self-organization in development, we really need to take this dual approach of both understanding emergent properties of development and the role of gene function in development, but also really to go back to quite classical approaches of experimental embryology to perturb things at the higher length scales and follow how cells respond to that and understand downward causation in this context. And I really want to point out the techniques such as live modeling that hope to really form a middle ground here, where we can begin to start to be predictive about how cells will respond to these larger scale morphogenetic manipulations. Okay, so just to finish here, on acknowledgement side, just want to thank the new version of the lab now, so thank everybody there for their contributions. I mentioned who's contributed directly to the work through the talk. Thanks to funders such as the Wellcome Trust and the UKRI. Okay, thanks very much for listening.